Some time ago, on Friday, I discussed actually we constructed the representation of our Poisson algebra, the quantum representation, on the space of functions on a space of functions on a group, and we didn't really say it, what kind of space of function it is. And today we need, as you know, Hilbert space means something more than just saying it's a space of functions. So we need an inner product. And since we discussed the fluxes, so these act as derivative operators, and more concretely, they act as left invariant derivative operators. And so what do you want typically from your operators or observables in quantum mechanics? Self-adjointness, indeed. And so self-adjointness is a bit more than symmetry, so we will mostly discuss just symmetry. And typically for multiplication operators, the symmetry is kind of obvious because you just, for real functions, because you just multiply and you can change that in any inner product which comes with a multiplicative measure. So if you have mu x, a measure, and you define your inner product, I'm not sure where I do that on the right. Yeah, let's, maybe it's on the first entry, doesn't, okay. Like this, then having a multiplication operator, say, which just multiplies the function, and if this operator is real, you can write it in this entry or on this entry, so, which means that A, HF, G, is typically f hg. so for multiplication operators, the symmetry is kind of obvious as long as we have a like reasonable measure. And the measure is not obvious because it's a group, it's a curved manifold, but it will be obvious in like in 10 minutes. So what we need to care about is the self-adjointness or the symmetry of the of our derivative operators. And so this is typically non-trivial. Now I'll write it again. Because imagine you just have this operator. And say you have some non-trivial function here, and now if you want to rewrite this by partial, you know, you have to actually do an integration by parts to show mm-hmm. symmetry. And if you have some non-trivial measure, it will act on the measure, and you get an extra term. So in this case, it's not obvious. what to do? I mean, this actually defines you kind of the measure also in Rn to be just dx in a sense, if you want to have the standard momenta to be symmetric. Okay, so we said that these are left invariant derivative operators, and these derivative operators, they were defined actually as derivatives of Rieck translations. So if I can write it to you here again. So if you exponentiate this entire thing again, so this was the left invariant derivative. Acting on F. if you exponentiate the derivative operator, we expect that we actually get this Rieck translation in itself. And so the right translation, now I'm getting a bit confused with my H and G. Is to be defined is defined just similarly to a translation in Rn, where you say you translate an argument x by x plus 5 or something. So here you define the right translation by multiplying the argument of a function on the right. And actually, you can check that this is really a group action. Which means that if you do two translations from the right, it defines you actually a representation of the group. So as a little exercise, you can check that this is hopefully the case. which means that this right translation defines your representation on the space of functions. Okay, so these are called right translations. And since there's a right, there's also a left. As you can guess, so in Rn you don't have this, or you have this, but left translation is equal to right translation because it's you deal with the additive group, which is abelian. So in this case, you actually define LH. So don't be confused. So here the derivative, the left invariant derivative, comes as the derivative of the right translation. And the right invariant derivative will come as a derivative of the left translation. And so you multiply from the left. However, to get this group action property, this one, you need to actually multiply with the inverse from the left. And this is just because of these ordering things, and inverting changes the ordering. So you can again check that you actually get this property, hopefully. And so since we have these fluxes and want them to be symmetric or self-adjoint, so if we exponentiate them and get the right translation, we want the right translation to be unitary. And so this means that we're actually looking for a measure and unitary means that it's an action which does not change the inner product. So looking for a measure which is invariant under right translations. And so if you get this on the SAR group, on the Lie group, we will get, we can hope to get the symmetric flux operator. In fact, it turns out that there exists a measure. And I already told you it's a so-called Haar measure. And it exists for all compact Lie groups, actually. And in this case, this Haar measure is it's left and right invariant. Or at least exists for all compact semi-simple Lie groups. It's left and right invariant. And so this actually So there's a theorem which then tells you that this is unique up to normalization. Which is nice, so we go for this measure. And with these two arguments, you can make, with this argument, it's actually also invariant under inversion. And so in the usual way of writing transformations of measures, this means that DHG will be equal to dg, will be equal to dgh, so from the right, and the measure will be equal under inversion. It basically means this. And so it's nice that such a structure exists for at least these compact Lie groups. And so having this measure, we can, of course, so I will write you in 5 minutes what this measure actually is in SU2. And there's a general formula which for other Lie groups. I had this one. Now let's try this. So with this measure, we can of course just define our inner product between two functions on the group fg, ff prime, because g is a bit too confusing. Psi 1, psi 2. To be the integral over the group and then here we take basically the Haar measure and so this will be indeed invariant under right translation and so using these abstract formulas there can write this. And the usual thing is that you make a coordinate transformation here, g prime. And so g is equal to g prime h minus 1. And so this is equal to g, this becomes g prime h minus 1. However, we know that this is a Haar measure. So this is dg prime. And we get basically back just the inner product. Between these two functions, C1, C2. Oop. And so this is how you use this invariance of the measure in calculations. You usually have to apply a coordinate transformation and then use that you measure is invariant on the left or right or inversion multiplication. Okay. Then there will be another comment. So let's actually define what is the Haar measure on SE2. And so I told you there is a general formula which just gives you the Haar measure in certain parameters for your group. But here we have SU2, and the thing which I didn't really describe to you is that SU2 as a manifold can be identified with a 3-sphere. So this is a boundary of the unit ball in R4. And if you do that, and you know, actually this follows just from writing any group element G as the exponential of alpha nj tj, and tj where our is our basis of Lie algebra elements. Nj is a 3D unit vector. And alpha can vary in 0 and 2 pi, because if you go, if you do a rotation and you go over to 2 pi, you actually do that once again, and that is already SU2, because for SO3 you have to identify the case that n is equal to minus n, and you do a half rotation by pi, and so on. So this tells you that the 3D unit vector will be 2 angles, and here you have a 3rd angle, so you parameterize the group elements by 3 angles, and so I could, I don't know, it's not just, so you can actually write this as 2 by 2 matrix in terms of these n and alpha, which will not be very enlightening at the moment. So you have three, so you have parameters on SU2. And so you have alpha, these are 3 angles, and so this will be alpha. Psi and phi. And psi and phi are basically the 2 parameters which come from the normalized 3 vector. So phi will be also vary from 0 to 2 pi, and so psi will be actually the angle which gives you the, yeah, I don't know, latitude. What? which goes from the north to the south pole on your globe. So you can identify these as a point in your 3-sphere. And since we have lots of rotations, it turns indeed out that doing a left translation or multiplying your group element from the right or from the left, you actually get a rotation on this of the 3-sphere. So what you want to write is especially a measure on the 3-sphere, which is invariant in a rotation. However, this three-sphere is embedded in R4. And so we know a measure which is invariant under rotation in R4, which is basically the Cartesian measure. And so what you have to do is to pull back the Cartesian measure from R4 to the three-sphere, which just means that you write it in angular in radial coordinates and put r equal to 1. And that gives you your measure. And then you only have to normalize. And normalization means just that with a z or with an s, whatever. Normalization means that integrating the function f equal to 1 over your three-sphere or your group, you want this to be 1. So you just integrate with the volume of your three-sphere. And so we have alpha, and we have this parametrization of our normal vector. And then as pullback, you get just a generalization from the formula you know for R3. Okay, so you get actually this result, and this is the so-called Haar measure. And so in case you have to do an explicit integration, which doesn't really happen so often, you would have to write your g in terms of these parameters, so which means in this form. And use this integration measure. Of course, once you have that, you can actually rewrite this measure into any other parametrization you like. And then you have to apply the typical the Jacobi determinant to get the measure in other parametrizations. OK, so this is the Haar measure. And we discussed this normalization. So, and so this means something which is a bit unusual. We are on a compact space. So, and what you know, it's much more, it's a more complicated version, not of R, but actually of S1. So, if you ever quantized a particle on a circle. And so this means that actually f, this function that f is equal to 1, is normalizable. And so this function 1, let's call it this. It's an element of your of our Hilbert space, which will be called actually square integrable functions. So with this measure, it's the square integrable functions of on our group SU2, which is called capital G with respect to the Haar measure, dG. And then you can take any kind of L which you want. And so this is a bit, so this is really a proper state on in your Hilbert space. So it's different from R, where the constant function is not in your Hilbert space. And this means that you can actually, this state is also special. So because the constant function is not in the L2R space, it means that you don't have a function which would make all momenta kind of zero and all fluctuations of your momenta being equal to zero. So here you have a state which where all kind of combinations of fluxes with respect to the state are actually zero. And so this is actually called the Arshtika-Lewandowski vacuum. And so this form of LQG is actually very special because it's based really on this vacuum and finite excitations from this vacuum in a sense. And so the finite excitations will change this property, but only in a finite amount. And so since very recently there's another vacuum written down by somebody and somebody, and so this will be not the case. But there's an alternative vacuum. Which is very recent. And so there you would have actually have that if you consider closed holonomies, all kinds of closed holonomies, this will be actually the identity operator. So we can't actually speak yet of this vacuum because I only told you what the Hilbert space of one edge is, and then there's no closed holonomies. But this is an idea. But this is the basic idea. However, you know, there's all these subtleties. So this alternative vacuum, it actually happens that only the exponentiated fluxes exist as operators. And so the fluxes themselves don't exist as operators. So only the right translations exist. OK. So but this will be, yeah, so this is called kinematical, typically, often. Also, in a sense, it satisfies all equation of motion. But it's a very boring vacuum, in a sense, because all if all the fluxes vanish, it means that you have a totally spatial degenerate geometry in this case. And so you have a state which is completely peaked on all the fluxes. So what you have in this case, but it also happens for the particle, that you can sharply peak on fluxes here, actually. So also for the particle on a circle, you can sharply peak on zero momentum. So you don't have Gaussians. So if you do L2R, it's a lot about Gaussians, because they give you basically integrable functions. But here it will be more this constant function and everything finite which you can generate from it by applying holonomy operators. Okay. So we have our Hilbert space. So this will be our Hilbert space for one edge. And basically, later we will introduce more edges and so on. And it will be basically a tensor product of these Hilbert spaces. And it will be the same inner product. So we are on a good way of understanding the complete Hilbert space. And Hilbert space comes with some nice structure. And so what would you usually like to have for your Hilbert space? A basis. And so there's actually a nice basis, which we discussed it like some time ago. Which kind of maximally diagonalize your flux operators, because in the principle, so So far, we are more or less working in the basis which diagonizes the holonomy operators, because they act as multiplication operators. And so multiplication operators, in a sense, are already diagonal. But then, since it's a continuous spectrum, they come with a continuous parameter, or it's a non-normalizable basis, because it would be the delta functions on peaked on J. Okay, so one not proper basis let me introduce this concept is the delta function. So this would be the delta function f. Let's define f h or psi h of g, which is the delta function g with the parameter h. And so the usual way you define it is how it acts. You know, since it's a distribution, you define it as a linear operator acting on some other nice states. And so now I can use fg. This is defined to be the evaluation of f in h. So it's similar to delta function x, x prime, or x minus x prime, which is peaked in x prime. So here it's peaked on h. But it's non-normal, it's not normalizable. So it doesn't give us a very nice basis. And so an alternative basis is given by diagonizing as much as possible the fluxes. And this basis, you could call Peter Weyl basis, and or Peter Weyl's basis. And so it comes from the Peter Weyl theorem. And this Peter Weyl theorem is just a generalization of the Fourier transform. So what I'm telling you is basically defining the Fourier transform for SE2 or for a compact Lie group. So this also exists for at least compact semi-simple Lie groups. And if you consider U1, for instance, it's also a group. And so here you would just have it's parameterized by one angle. Phi. And so in this case, Fourier transform means using a basis which is given by exponential of I and phi. And Fourier transform, I hope you learned it, that this is really a complete basis. And the Plancherel theorem tells you that it's complete. And it's also normalizable because you're actually on U1 and not on R. So here you have one example. And this basis, these basis elements give you actually, are actually matrix elements of the irreducible representations of S of U1. So U1 irreducible representations. So do you guys know what an irreducible representation is? Okay. Are labeled by N. So if psi equal to U1 means it's a representation of U1. So of course, you have exponential of I phi being equal to U1. Um, So this representation associates to G. being equal to the exponential of I phi, a number, and so it's for abelian groups, all irreducible representations are actually one dimensional. There's a theorem to that, so that you have only one times one matrices, and so you have only numbers, and so the number is equal to the power of the nth power of the group element, and this is also called your character, and so on. And so here you have basically that the matrix elements of the set of all irreducible representations are giving you a basis, and it's not actually the set of all irreducible representations because there's a notion of equivalence classes of irreducible representations. And so we have to go through all the sets, through all these things. So basically, consider set of equivalence classes of irreducible representations of your compact semisimple Lie group G, and so equivalence classes means if you have a representation D, so it comes with a matrix, and you transform it with any unitary operator to some other representation, here it would be M prime, N prime, because here you have N, N prime, and here you have M. these two representations are equivalent. So for SU2, what are the irreducible representations? So they are labeled. By spins or half spins, and I will call these things J. So J can be 0, 1 half, 1, and so on. Okay. And so for each member, or for one, for so we have to choose one member of each equivalence class of these irreducible representations. And so we get, since it's a representation, and actually for compact semi-simple Lie groups, it turns out that your unitary, I didn't mention that. So I always assume unitary representations. So that's an important fact. So for compact semi-simple Lie groups, all these representations are finite dimensional. So we have these representation matrices and so we have here this label J and it's a matrix, so we have matrix indices. Do we call it M and N? Yes, so we have this representation labels M and N, and M and N for J dimensional representation. Yeah.
What is the importance of having unitary representations?
So unitary unitary will give you actually for the spaces relates then to the integrability of the matrix elements. That's one thing. And and then later, actually, because we will see that we will have an action on these matrix elements, you have an action of right and left translations. And so they will act actually in the given representation. And then unitarity means that these right and left translations are indeed unitary. Okay. So otherwise, the right and left translations would not be unitary.
So it has nothing to do like with the motivation that one has, for example, in QFT of having unitary representations of, let's say, the Poincaré group to have conservation of probability or something like that?
No, not yet. No, not yet. So this unitary is rather that we want finally the left and right translations to be unitary operators. And that's one reason. Okay, so M, so here you know that, or I don't know if you don't know it. So for a given J value, you get actually a 2J plus one dimensional representation. And so. These indices on your matrix go from minus j to j in integer steps. Okay, and that gives you basically a set of matrix of a set of functions on the group. So it's labeled by j, m, and n. And so basically, finally, we discussed all these things. And so finally, we have actually this Peter Weil theorem. Which states that DJMN going through all these allowed values of J, M, and N, so where M and N depends on J, or the range of M and N depends on J, is a complete so here it's orthogonal. It will be also normal if I normalize by some dimension factors, which is a bit of a trivial step. Of your Hilbert space. So I'm not going to prove it, but you can find the proof in the right books. Among them, like books on compact Lie groups. And so to normalize, we actually, or let me just state what this inner product is. Between two matrix elements so I do complex conjugation on the left entry and so the only factor which of course you will always forget or forget whether it's the inverse or whatever it's a 1 over the dimension of of your representation. So dj will be 2j is 2j plus 1 in our case, the dimension of the representation j, and then you have lots of conical deltas, dj. M and M prime and N and N prime and so on. And so we can introduce normalized states G, J, which we will call JMN. And so the in the bracket notation, this will be given by square root of the dimension times our group element. And writing this in this notation, you already see that you can come up with the definition of Fourier transform. So here we have orthogonality, and then we have completeness. And this is basically in the bracket notation. It's again the usual formula. So you have to sum over everything, over all these labels. And this means it's a complete basis. So you get the identity operator on your Hilbert space. And so, yeah, so this is actually the basis. I told you that it will maximally generalize the fluxes, diagonalize the fluxes. And as you could see, the fluxes on one edge is basically SE2 angular momentum algebra. And if you remember your angular momentum basis, it means that you can diagonalize the Casimir of this, which is basically the E squared and one component, EZ. And so this will allow us in short time, maybe not today, to actually quantize our first geometrical operator, which is the length of a curve. So in 2D, it would have been the area of some triangle or something. And so here will be the length of a curve. And since I say diagonalize, it means that some of these discrete values will determine your spectrum. And so we will have that actually the spectrum is discrete, as is the case for the momentum operator on U1, which we discussed here. And so we discussed the delta function here. And so, okay, we can spontaneously try to expand the delta function in this new basis. But I give you the easier exercise is to check that this is really the right result. And so I even give you the easier thing, which is the one and one, the delta function centered in the identity element. That's the dimension. Hopefully that is correct. And this is supposed to convince yourself that this is given as the sum over the dimension times the so-called character, and the character of G is defined to be the trace of your representation matrix element. And so this is again a formula which holds for all compact Lie groups. And it's quite important if you ever do calculations with Lie groups and all these things. Okay. So this, if you put in the characters, all these formulas from here, you see that this result is correct because I hope modulo normalization. If you use that, this is actually the character labeled by n a hook I phi. You see that you, in this case, you just get the sum over all exponential I and phi. And this is supposed to give you the delta function on U1. Okay. Once you have this delta function, you can easily define the other delta functions with the label H by the left or right translations you have, actually, because you just translate your argument, and then you translate where it's actually peaked on. And yeah, so we have this spin network as this matrix elements dj mn as a basis. Yeah.
The SU2 algebra, right?
Yeah.
So we're choosing this, I mean, we're choosing the states of my Hilbert space to be the matrices or the matrix elements instead of the vectors on which the representation are.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we trading those things? Like, because.
So it will be a bit clearer. So what you have, so indeed it turns out that our Hilbert, that's what I'm going to, wanted to tell you now, okay. Is that. You know, so we didn't make a choice. It's actually kind of a theorem. It is a theorem. But indeed, it will turn out. So now I wanted to explain, and that will be, if I manage, that this will be actually the tensor product of, yeah, depending on where you write this. J pi, let me check where I, okay, apparently I write it here. Oh. That if I have L2G, actually the holonomies later, they will change the J label, so we couldn't go to a fixed J, to fixed, you know, this J, not G. J being the representation label. And it will turn out that this is a direct sum of representation spaces, but you take the tensor product, and this is a so-called dual representation, and this is a standard representation. And you can actually get that from considering the action of left and right translations. On your basis, so what we will actually have is that we will have our edge, and so this is associated to a G by the Fourier transform. We have a J label associated to this edge, and then an n index here and an m index here. And so keeping one fixed, this will give you a representation space Vj or Vj star, we will see in a minute. And keeping the other fixed, it will give you the other thing. So you have an, on both ends, you will have a representation space sitting in a sense. And this you just see by figuring out how these left and right translation act, because these will be, or you know, because it's, I told you the basis diagonalizes maximally the thingy, the fluxes, and the left and right translations are kind of exponentiation of the fluxes. So these will keep at least certain subspaces invariant, and indeed it leaves the J invariant and more. So this is quite easy. So the left Greig translation is defined as putting an H here, and then you can expand it again by the representation property. So this is a representation matrix. If you take it by, with two group elements, it's a representation. Means that you just get M P G D J P N H. So what you have here is I apply an operator to a vector in my Hilbert space. And on the right-hand side, I get combination of my vectors again with certain coefficients. And so these coefficients are these, because these functions define me my vector. So if I write it in these normalized bracket notation, I get this result that the right action on a matrix element here is given by this combination times this matrix element. So this means, yeah, we discussed before, the right translations give you a representation on L to G. So they actually have lots of invariant subspaces. So this subspace is labeled by J and by M. And so the vector representation is given by letting N run. And so here you get this, this representation, DJPNH. And so this apparently is a proper representation. And we have found, what we have found is this vector Vj in our L2G space. So we have lots of these Vjs. Lots of means we have as many as there are m's. So two j plus one Vjs, basically, in our L2G k. So this gives is a sub representation of L2G dg carrying a representation dj of vj, depends on how you define things. And so this will be the right translations. As you can guess, there will be also the left translations. And since the right translations do something on the right, and so they affect this index, the left do something on the left, so they will affect the other index. And then the only thing which happens is this dualization, which I define next week. So dual representations are, however, unitary equivalent to a representation for SU2. So that doesn't change much. But this gives us at least this. Now I'm usually confusing this. So now Mn. So now we interpreted at least this end of our edge as an SE2 algebra. And so we will find on the other end, basically, is in a sense a conjugated SE2 algebra. Okay. Tomorrow, and I guess tomorrow I'm also going to quantize the length operator and finish with this one edge business, and we go to three edges. No. We go to vertices, basically solving the Gauss constraints. Okay, so let's close here.